the parasympathetic nervous system, freeze or collapse, works to keep us from having a heart attack or dying from a broken heart. It decides how much pain we can handle and selects from a menu of options: slow down, partial freeze, or collapse. When our brains and bodies become too overwhelmed, they are automatically programmed to conserve energy by shutting our systems down. Some women find that their bodies collapse under long-term stress. Since Dr. Patrick Carnes' research says it can take 3 to 5 years to treat sex addiction, we can be left with long-term distress for weeks, months, and even years. The ongoing sexual discoveries, lies, and ruptures of trust are paralyzing. Helplessness can take us by storm, and we can go limp with resignation. Learned helplessness arises out of post-traumatic stress when we give up and stop trying to get the help we need. Without change, it can lead us down a one-way street towards depression. Many women in this situation think, "Why try? It doesn't help anyway." Or, "If I just ignore it, maybe then it will go away." We've got to get our bodies help. Like a dependent child, the body needs us to take care of it. While the brain does what it needs to do to save us in that moment, it doesn't serve us long term. Tragically, without intervention, our bodies can either remain in high alert or shut down indefinitely. In some cases, the stress can even become fatal. It's a matter of life and death. You matter. These are the most difficult paragraphs I've written because I know where you are and what you're dealing with. I see the faces of women I've met or treated over the years, women who have ended up with life-threatening illnesses from the impact of their trauma. When you're so overwhelmed by what's happening to you and you don't get the care your body needs, trauma can take a turn for the worse. Maybe it's because you don't know what you don't know, or because you're frozen and have pulled the covers over your head just to survive. Maybe it's a nagging trauma-induced shame belief that sounds something like, "I'm not worth the time, money, or hassle to get what I need." I've had some women ask, "Why should I have to seek treatment when this is his fault?" Whatever the reason, it becomes our issue when we're traumatized. You deserve the right to make a choice. You deserve to heal. Taking care of yourself is the antidote, and I hope you choose you. Let me explain. Like the general of an army equipped for battle, your body is prepared to protect itself in the face of danger. When your heart starts pumping and shots of adrenaline are going into your body, digestion stops and your immune system shuts down. Who needs to eat or fight immune-related illnesses when you're in serious trouble, right? Here are some of the women I've worked with whose bodies bear the burden of their traumas. Jennifer developed chronic irritable bowel syndrome. Janice had a pacemaker installed in her heart at age 56. Sherry contends with ongoing bouts of fibromyalgia. Rhonda continues to miss work because of her Epstein-Barr. Julie fought uterine cancer and won. She worries it might come back. Carrie has had numerous emergency room visits for her panic attacks. Celine has been struggling with headaches, ulcers, and adrenal fatigue for months. Her physician just told her she has diverticulitis. Raylene is a cancer survivor and underwent chemotherapy for her limbic brain tumor. Remember, that's the part of the brain where highly charged emotional memories are stored. Debbie could hardly walk from the car to the restaurant before dinner. She needed surgery to repair her mitral and tricuspid valves. The doctor said they were stretched out like long dangling cords due to stress. She's 53. These women bear the imprints of long-term stress. For some of them, the betrayal happened years ago, but their bodies are still behaving as if they're in the midst of it. Your body does its best to resolve short-lived traumas, a burglary, fender bender, temporary job loss, or three armed police officers in your home. There's a beginning and an end to most of these. But when it's longer-term stress, you can help manage your body's arousal thermostat by expanding your comfort zone and giving your body what it needs to repair. How to stay calm, cool, and connected. The comfort zone, also known as our window of tolerance, is a healthy range in the body, a baseline that restores the body to peace after it's been stressed. Sexual betrayal puts our bodies into an alarm state. If our brains and bodies work too hard, we can get stuck in fight or flight, run too hot. The opposite is also true. If our brains and bodies stay overwhelmed and overloaded too long, they can freeze and may even collapse to compensate, stuck in a frozen state. As you can imagine, neither extreme is good for us. We need tools to soothe our bodies and skills to quiet our emotions so we can rest and repair. Consider marathon runners who need to have good shoes, ample water, and breaks to pace their bodies through the entire race. If they sprint the whole time, they'll collapse before reaching the finish line. When we talk about the comfort zone, it's what helps you stay calm, cool, and connected. Listen and identify any skills you're currently practicing. Deep, slow breathing, ongoing support groups, sleep 7 to 9 hours a night, dialectical behavior therapy, mindfulness, meditation, and yoga, boundaries for yourself and others, spiritual faith journey, replacing negative trauma-induced shame beliefs with positive truths about yourself, self-soothing, self-care, self-compassion. Listening to yourself, trust your gut. Grounding exercises to be in the here and now. Are there any new tools I mentioned you might be willing to try? As you make yourself a priority, it is possible to walk your body back into health and rest. By doing these suggestions, along with other self-care tasks in Chapter 18, we can feel more calm, cool, and connected. While we don't have control over the things that happen to us, we do have control over how we manage the stress itself. To heal trauma, we need to take care of ourselves by intentionally making choices to manage life's daily challenges and triggers. By broadening our toolbox and honoring what's inside the comfort zone, we can give our bodies what they need to regulate stress. We do it for us. Chapter 12, Quick on the Trigger. We don't find triggers, triggers find us. Like an unexpected ambush, triggers take us by surprise. It's the horn that sounds, the bell that rings, the gut-wrenching pit in the stomach that puts our bodies into high alert. When there's a rumble in the house, Ugg draws his club and prepares us to rock and roll. Triggers call out to a deep cavern of pain inside of us. As in the case with warning labels, their goal is to alert us and keep us from harm. Triggers remind us of something familiar, a painful event that took our breath away and stored the carnage out of sight. Sometimes triggers are completely obvious. With sexual betrayal, it might be a scantily dressed woman on a magazine cover, a seductive TV commercial, or a mannequin in a lingerie store as we walk through the mall. Flesh, breasts, and booty. Sensual body parts that have stolen our husbands' hearts. Summertime trips to the beach can be incredibly triggering. Copper-toned bodies in bikinis were nothing more than a mausoleum of misery for me. It wasn't always that way. Growing up, I lived with the anticipation of heading to the beach and playing in the sun. I was free. I remember how good I felt in a swimsuit kissed by the sun. Now, the beach wasn't safe. Not because of a Hollywood blockbuster about a great white shark. It was warm sand with women who left no room for imagination and men who groped for more. Other times, triggers are more subtle. A receipt on the counter, an elusive glance at a woman across the room, or a comment made about a meeting with a coworker. Triggers can be anniversary dates, or D-days, as we call them. These are times etched in history when we discovered he was lying again. We remember these events not because we want to, but because the situations deeply hurt us. Our birthday or wedding anniversary might even be a trigger when these are meaningful dates he avoids. These traumatic events become crystallized in our minds and suspended like stormy clouds over a calendar. Whether we are aware of it or not, triggers can happen anywhere. They're real. Not so Merry Christmas. Once a year, my friend Dan hosts a holiday celebration featuring menus from all over the world. This festive occasion warrants some impressive food and the promise of a trophy for the best chef. One year, when I had been divorced for more than 15 years, I ventured out and invited a gentleman I really liked, a man I'd been dating for several months. Dan also had invited a date. As the party geared up, I was baking away in Dan's kitchen, doting on beautiful crab cakes nestled in scallop seashells. Artful appetizers, way more work than any one woman should do. The doorbell rang, and in walked Mary. Mary was a platinum blonde bombshell, size 1, and a black skin-tight cocktail dress with a red satin bow wrapped around her waist. Seriously, did she come dressed as a package to be enwrapped or placed under the tree? You get the picture. Ugg and Amy, the emotional brain, jumped in a car and couldn't get to Vegas fast enough. They sent out an all-points bulletin from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. It was like an I Love Lucy sitcom, bombshell meets clamshell. There I was, up to my elbows, in a hot, steamy kitchen, fussing over crab cakes. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched Mary let out a playful giggle. Wouldn't you know it, she knew my date. Apparently, they had been in theater together. Could it get any worse? I did the math. Each set of crab cakes took 12 minutes in the oven. There were 40 people. Every few minutes, I'd stick my head outside the kitchen and see Mary talking with my date. Whether they were on the back patio or chattering amidst other singles, Mary kept popping up like Waldo in a cruel picture book. It was horrible. As the night went on, I could feel heat rising in my body and rage directed at Mary and my date. Seriously, maybe he'd rather be with her, I thought. Amy and her cousin Harmony opened the filing cabinets of my mind. Together, we sorted drawer after drawer, looking at files of other times I'd been replaced. Thousands. Triggered beliefs flooded my mind, while waves of hurt and fear put my body into panic. I can't compete. I'm not good enough. I'm not pretty enough or sexy enough to keep his attention. I'm ugly. My body's not perfect. I can't trust anyone. A drawbridge came up around the castle of my heart as I released alligators into the moat. My poor date didn't have a chance. Guilty as charged. Here's a man who had never betrayed me, but I had him behind bars in a baggy orange suit with shackles. It was a long drive home that included stretches of silence sprinkled with angry rants. I was mad. I asked him why he spent so much time talking with Mary. He looked dazed. At one point, he even tried to speak, but nothing soothed me. He was a man, and she was a woman. That's all the evidence I needed. We stopped in front of my house. He was quiet. He calmly said, "Sherry, I've never seen this side of you before." What more could I say? I didn't feel embarrassed or wrong about my concern. We broke up that night. I couldn't understand why my date looked strangely relieved as he drove away. My heart had been bloodied and wounded. I had weathered thousands of hits in the rejection department. In that moment, I felt justified and safe. Tears ran down my cheeks as I thought, I'll never be able to trust men. My house became still, and the anger quieted within me. It was then I heard my CEO come back online. I began to replay how everything had gone down that night. It was late, but I decided to call Dan. I was sure he'd be interested in taking my call, since Mary was his date, after all. I filled Dan in and told him how angry I was that my date talked to his date for 45 minutes. Dan: "So, Sherry, how do you know it was 45 minutes? Sherry: "The hair on the back of my neck bristled. "Well, I baked 45 crab cakes on cookie sheets. That's about 45 minutes. Every time I looked outside the kitchen, Mary and my date were talking." Dan: "So when did you first notice you were upset?" Sherry: "What do you mean?" "Great. Just what I need, a good old boys club. Not the type of support I was looking for." Dan: "What I mean is, how many minutes into the 45 minutes did it take before you felt afraid?" Sherry: "Well, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 minutes. Dan: "There was a pregnant pause on the other end of the line, as if Dan was bracing himself. So Sherry, did you ever think you might have been triggered?" Dan's not only a really good friend, he's also a wise person who's earned the right to ask me that question. The nickel drop. Oh, Dan, I didn't even think about that. I got triggered. Mary was my enemy. I despised her dress, loathed her body, and coveted her platinum blonde hair. I hated someone I'd never met, just because she was a woman. I didn't stop to think that while I was in the kitchen cooking crab cakes, Dan was hosting a house full of people. Our dates were talking with others in the room. I started to cry as I realized how threatened I felt and how deep this wound went inside of me. I was shocked to be triggered 15 years after my betrayal and felt horrified over how I had treated my date. It was a pocket of pain I needed to heal if I ever wanted to find love and trust again. Waves of an aftershock. A trigger is something that reminds us of a hurtful situation in our past. For some of us, the trigger may be about what's happening right now. If you have recently experienced another betrayal, you may be reacting to a triggering event much like an aftershock. Whether it's 15 years or 15 minutes, if something feels similar, it sets our body off. These time-stamped, emotionally fused memories can overtake us and cause us to react. Like an unfinished story held in suspension, they create alarm signals that warn us and keep us in a state of high alert. When they hook us, it's exhausting. When we've got bigger fish to fry. I love to fish. During one trip to Alaska, we hired Captain Jerry to take 3 of us out for several hours. Much to our surprise, we caught our limit, 18 beautiful wild Alaskan salmon. We decided to have a fish cannery professionally fillet, flash freeze, and FedEx the salmon to our front door. It was well worth the expense. Each time I open a package, the salmon tastes as fresh as the day we caught it. Our traumatic events can be flash frozen and pop up on our front door too. When we're triggered, the sensations and feelings from our past can feel like they're happening right now. These memories have been preserved and automatically stored with fragmented snapshots of our story, trauma-induced shame beliefs, body sensations, thoughts, and emotions. Triggers are our body's way of telling us there's more, more to tend to, and more to heal. We've got bigger fish to fry, so our triggers lead us into the pockets of pain that need our attention. Our triggers typically come from the following sources. Betrayal trauma. Wounds of omission, the good things we needed but didn't get, and wounds of commission, the things that happened to us that shouldn't happen to anyone. Earlier traumas underneath our current betrayals can make our triggers even more potent. So when the wounds from our past are triggering us in the present, it's not our past anymore. We're not made to hold shame and painful emotions long term. It's toxic. We have to deal with them. Leftovers in our fridge. Let's take a look at my trigger with Mary. Anger is a powerful, invulnerable emotion that carries the idea, you can't touch me or melt my heart. The last thing I wanted to do at that moment was be vulnerable. Hidden underneath anger are often three vulnerable emotions, hurt, fear, and sadness. I didn't want to expose my soft underbelly and risk being eaten alive. I didn't go to the party thinking of my former marriage. I traveled light. Just my lipstick and enough crab cakes to feed an army. The trigger found me. Mary walked in the front door, and one glance brought my trauma-induced shame beliefs to the surface. Like leftovers of gut-wrenching goo stored in a refrigerator, my betrayal memories and shame beliefs were still in Tupperware containers and had been sitting on a shelf for quite some time. In Chapter 10, we'll look at what happens when we store leftovers in our fridge too long. The container bloats, the top burps off, and all we know is something really stinks when we open that door. Shame reeks and wreaks havoc in our lives. Making room in the fridge. Nobody likes to roll up their sleeves and clean out the fridge. But in the world of trauma recovery, it's a necessity, as we're trying to defuse emotions connected to historical landmines. In situations like my reaction to Mary, I now check my pulse and kindly say to myself, if it's hysterical, it's historical. I went back into therapy and was able to do some EMDR to clean out those shame containers and replace them with the truth about myself. I worked until I shifted my beliefs to, I'm enough, just as I am. And my body doesn't have to be perfect for me to be loved. While I still feel twinges and get triggered from time to time, those are very manageable. Sometimes I even say the truth out loud so I can hear it. It's so much nicer to live without the stench. Here's a trigger awareness exercise I've used to help me sort out what's underneath my triggers. The goal is to help connect the dots and bring a greater awareness of where the trigger is coming from. The exercise gives me those aha moments and helps me identify the shame beliefs and emotions that are attached to the trigger. As you go through these steps, be gentle with yourself rather than judging whether what you did was wrong or right. This process is about learning. I'll use my story about Mary as an example. This is what I call my trigger awareness exercise. Step 1. Review the triggering event. In a few sentences, describe the event and specific details that bother you. Journal it out. Example, see the story above about my experience with Mary at the dinner party. Step 2. See it and say it. In your mind's eye, view the event as if you were seeing that moment on a movie screen. What part of your story represents the worst part or parts of your experience? Example, there were two worst parts with Mary. 1. Each time I looked out of the kitchen, my date was with her. 2. She was beautiful, size 1, and wore a black dress and a bow around her waist. Perfect body. I couldn't compete. Step 3. Name the shame. Ask yourself this question. What is the negative shame belief about myself in light of what happened to me, as we heard about in step 2? Try to phrase this as an I statement. I am blank. I cannot blank. I don't blank, etc. Let me give you an example. I can't trust anyone, and I'm not in control. I'm ugly. I can't compete, and I'm not good enough. I'm helpless, unable to stop Mary and my date from talking. Step 4. How did this triggering event make you feel? If you mentioned anger, were you feeling hurt, fear, or sadness too? Let me give you an example. I felt anxious, angry, heartbroken, betrayed, panicked, worthless, afraid, and hurt. Step 5. Identify what you were feeling in your body. Example, my heart raced, my chest tightened, and my hands were shaking. Step 6. How did the trigger impact your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors? Were there any consequences or reactions you regret? Let me give you an example. I was cold and pulled away from my date. I wanted to leave the party early. I reacted with anger. I felt justified in confronting my date. My boyfriend and I broke up that night. Step 7. Float back and call to mind any earlier memories that seem familiar. Are any of your feelings and shame beliefs similar? Let me give you an example. I felt replaced by other women. No matter what I did, I couldn't compete. I couldn't trust men. I can see how I took my hurt out on my date. When I think back to the past, I felt out of control and didn't know how to stop Connor's behavior. Step 8. Now use the 180-degree turnaround to take the shame beliefs in step 3 and turn them around. By using this insight, what would you like to believe about yourself now? How can you begin to tell yourself the truth? Example, I am a caring and loving person who has been deeply hurt. I am good enough just the way I am. My body doesn't have to be perfect for me to be loved. I can make choices and decide whom to trust. I can give myself grace and learn how to risk sharing my vulnerable feelings. Step 9. What do you need? How can you reach out for support from your spouse, loved one, or friend? Chapter 15 provides tips for an intentional ask. Connecting the dots with your spouse is a vulnerable step in helping him understand your reaction. Do you need to talk about the trigger? Ask for validation? Make amends? Let me give you an example. I needed to be heard, so I reached out to Dan. I needed to be loved to know that I was okay even though I'm imperfect. I made amends to my date. I can ask for a hug or get reassurance when I'm triggered. Step 10. Is there any insight or spiritual truth that has come from this experience? Let me give you an example. I'm glad God loves me warts and all and doesn't leave me when things get messy. Even though others have rejected me, I can trust God. When besieged, I'm calm as a baby. When all hell breaks loose, I'm collected and cool. You've always been right there for me. Don't turn your back on me now. Don't throw me out. Don't abandon me. You've always kept the door open. Psalms chapter 27, verses 3 and 9. Building a portable medical toolbox. Under every trigger is an unhealed wound. As our wounds heal, our triggers lessen. While I can honestly say my triggers are few and far between, like a war veteran who's lived through years of betrayal, I can still occasionally be surprised by them. Time has taught me that whatever emotions I'm feeling today, whether good or bad, most likely will pass. Knowing how to take care of myself when triggers surface makes all the difference in the world as to whether I soothe my pain or possibly hurt someone else. Triggers can cause us to harm ourselves or others when we react in rage or self-medicate through excessive food, shopping, alcohol, or drugs. Below are some tools that can help direct you to sources of healthy comfort. Whether your husband's in recovery or not, it's critical that you build a portable medical toolbox for yourself. While your toolbox may look different from mine, we all need to have tools to grab and ready supports when our bodies go into full alert. Resuscitation mask. Breathe, breathe, and breathe. Breathing is often underrated. Because we do it every day, we don't realize what a powerful tool it can be when we're triggered. Use the four elements exercise to decrease the stress response, relax your body, and be in the here and now. Number one, earth. Take a minute to get your feet on solid ground. Sit down and firmly touch the floor with your feet. Look around and notice three things. See each and listen to yourself say its name out loud. This helps to calm down Ugg and Amy and get your CEO back online. 2. Air. Take a minute to do about a dozen deep, slow, belly-filling breaths. Breathe in through your nose for 3 seconds and then hold for 1 second. Then slowly breathe out through your mouth for 3 seconds. When you breathe out slowly, your heart rate calms down. 3. Water. Make saliva in your mouth and swish it around for 30 seconds. When you make saliva, it turns on your digestive system and helps your body relax and get back into the comfort zone. 4. Fire. Use your mind to fire up a good memory of a calm place that brings you relaxation. Some people see the ocean, a favorite pet, or a green meadow. What is it for you? Engage your senses by asking what you would see, hear, smell, taste, or touch. CPR kit. Your heart has stopped and needs to be resuscitated. You need safety at this moment, a warm voice, and people you can trust. This will help put Amy at rest. Call a friend who gets you and talk through what's happening. Emergency blanket. Comfort is key. What does your body need to calm down? It might be a brisk walk, a soft blanket, cleaning the house, hugging your pet, a hot shower, a piece of dark chocolate, or taking a nap. I call these things hugs for Ugg. They remind your body that you care. Wound closures. You're trying to bandage an open wound. Be kind to yourself. Take time to work out the trigger awareness exercise earlier in this chapter. Journaling the feelings you're having shortly after you're triggered can help you make connections between where you are now and what's in your past. Together, Amy, her cousin Harmony, and the CEO can help you connect the dots. Cotton swabs. Be kind and gentle with yourself. No need to feel angry or ashamed. Triggers find us. Just acknowledge you've been triggered. Step away from the situation, breathe, and use the four elements exercise to get your brain and body back online. In chapter 18, we'll be looking at more interventions that can move us through triggers and trauma as we heal. SOS call. Meet with your counselor so they can help you look at what's come to the surface. Triggers won't last. Find a safe place to process the underlying traumas. Making choices to heal empowers us. First aid first. Having tools to manage our triggers is the first step in managing our pain. It's important to recognize that deeper trauma work has its place once we've been stabilized by setting boundaries, securing our support team, and building our portable toolbox. Timing is everything. Managing the essentials in our toolbox gives us the help our bodies need when we most need it. Chapter 13. Where is God now? I couldn't pull the comforter tight enough under my chin as I desperately tried to disappear into the painting on the wall. My eyes strained as I heard myself ask, "Why can't I go there?" An unexpected wave of frustration washed over me. Looking at the painting of a daisy-covered hillside made me feel contempt towards an artist I'd never met. My soul had grown dark. I was throwing darts at inanimate objects. I just couldn't claw my way out of the pain. Connor and I had been separated for 3 months. I felt like a displaced evacuee as I was the one away from our home. I hoped my distance would somehow rattle his cage of complacency. As I thought about it, a surprising surge of rage surfaced. There I was, staying in my friend's spare bedroom, a room dressed from floor to ceiling in Pepto-Bismol pink paint, Chantilly lace, and gingham. Then a thought went through my heart like a bullet. If I had a little girl, I'm sure she'd love this room. Without invitation, the tears came. I'll never hold my baby in these arms. "I can't trust you." My scream fell into an empty room. How can we even think about bringing a baby into this world? I remember the day we sat on our front porch and decided not to have children. Our marriage was a mess. Our lives were a mess. I longed for a baby. I longed to be safe. Another rush of anger came. Isn't that why I said I do? I hated to hear my thoughts. Even more, I hated to feel them. I didn't want to admit I felt absolutely alone. Battle-worn, overwhelmed, and weary of trying. I was stick-a-fork in it, charred, overcooked, and done. There was an ache in my chest, like vice grips clenched around my heart. This particular night, my soul cracked. I heard myself ask, "Where is God?" There was no answer. The Eternal One's reach is not so short that he cannot save you. His ear is not so deaf that he cannot hear you. Isaiah chapter 59, verse 1. I had memorized this verse years earlier, but now it wasn't true. Why hadn't God helped me? His lack of care felt personal. How can you let this happen? Does my heart really matter to you? Why aren't you doing anything about it? I know I'm not perfect, but I've done my best to serve you. And this is what I get? An unfaithful husband, humiliation, and the loss of my church and friends? Have you turned your back on me because I'm angry? Am I being punished for something I did? I couldn't take it anymore. In the deafening silence, I raised my fist and screamed, "I don't need you. I don't need you anymore. I can do this on my own." In that instant, I couldn't have been more convinced of my words. When you're distressed and someone gives you an answer you don't like, you deal with it. But when you're ignored in your most desperate moment, it feels like a thousand cuts of a knife. Finally, I said out loud what had been bouncing around in my head. Like the boomerang of an echo, my words hit the ceiling and ricocheted back in my face. It was then I listened and heard what I was really thinking. I saw God as my enemy, not my ally. I had lost hope. When things didn't change, not only did I believe Connor didn't care, I felt abandoned by God too. Somewhere between Sunday school lessons, flannel graphs, and fairy tales, I believed if I trusted God and did the right things, I would be protected from harm. Wrong. Simple answers to a simple faith didn't fit any longer. I was in a crisis of belief, a spiritual trauma caused by betrayal. My faith was no longer blind. I was standing there with two black eyes and horn mad. On the muddied heels of confusion, God became my enemy. Just like someone who wrongly kicks a dog, D-O-G, when they're angry, I got mad and kicked God, G-O-D. I had things backwards. Seeing God as my enemy was a reaction to my ongoing pain. Hearing myself say it out loud caused me to realize how confused I'd become. It was then I realized that my enemy wasn't God, but a force of darkness in this world. When we are dismantled by pain, we lose not only our way, but our faith as well. I kept getting my butt kicked and wanted out of that ring. I didn't want to fight anymore. I wanted to lie flat on the ground and have some referee say, 8, 9, 10, you're out. Defeat was better than death. How do you make sense of the real world with real pain when good and evil are standing chin to chin in the same room? I found my faith in a crazy quilt. Early in our marriage, Connor's mom stitched us a crazy quilt. 3 decades later, I still have this heirloom, handmade with love. It holds great memories. Laughter, scraps from funky shirts and holiday tablecloths, reminiscent of precious people I loved and still miss. Crazy quilts became popular during the Victorian era. Women spent hours cutting the fabric into splinters of odd shapes and triangles, turning the edges and thoughtfully arranging each piece to create colorful one-of-a-kind designs. The word crazy, to Victorian women, meant messy. In my case, crazy turned messy, and messy ripped a gaping hole right in the center of my quilt. There weren't clean edges around that tear. My faith was shredded by broken promises, devastating discoveries, messy losses, and dangling strings. Whatever your spiritual life looked like before you discovered the sexual betrayal, it looks different now. Sexual infidelity is both a crucible of pain and a catalyst of change. Some women hold on to God for all their worth. God becomes their only safe place and their faith deepens. Others erect spiritual walls around their heart to keep this reckless, uncaring God and the people of their faith community far, far away. Still others, despairing and brokenhearted, turn away from God altogether. For some of us, our spiritual lives have been ripped to shreds by the time we get into 12-step recovery. It's not surprising we get stuck on steps 2 and 3. We wrestle with the concept of surrendering to anything or anyone. So how are we supposed to project what we know onto this power, universe, supernatural being, or divinely created intention? One woman's relational trust and spirituality had become so wounded that she chose a vending machine as her higher power. As we think back to Martin Buber's I It and I Thou, this paradigm makes sense. Whenever she needed comfort, at least it never disappointed her. Thomas Merton, a monk, respected writer, and mystic once said, "We stumble and fall constantly, even when we are most enlightened. But when we are in true spiritual darkness, we do not even know that we have fallen." Relationship fractures can cause spiritual traumas that wound us to our core, making us question everything we might imagine about a trustworthy and caring higher power. Rebuilding my faith has looked a lot like stitching together pieces of my crazy quilt over time. I've spent years trimming the fat of trite religious answers, debating theologians, challenging clergy, and wrestling in the unknown of it all. I hate sitting in the dark, but I've learned how to fearlessly ask tough questions. I've discovered it's okay to disagree and be honest about where I'm at. I have dog-eared, tear-stained pages in my Bible where I wrestled with God through the loss of my home, 11 moves, job transitions, market crashes, and a barren womb. Somewhere along the way, I embraced the idea that my faith is a work in progress rather than an idea I grew up with. I've built a relationship with a God I know rather than one I've heard about. It's strange how pain can reshape our spiritual stories into something completely different. Regardless of where you are today with your belief in God, your personal story can be pieced back together. As part of my journey, I've come to know an almighty healer who cares about what's happened to you and wants to assist you on your path. The Great Faith Experiment. One evening, as an exercise of my own faith experience, I did a courageous thing. I asked God to help me see women who've been sexually betrayed with spiritual eyes. I wanted to get a picture of our wounds from God's perspective. Surprisingly, what I got was a gut-wrenching picture of a battle scene. I saw our hearts bloodied. I saw bruised bodies and faces, with heads bowed low, feeling helpless, worthless, shameful, afraid, and filled with rage. Shrapnel was still embedded in our arms, abdomens, and legs. Alone in my room, I fell to my knees and wept. Some of us have lost everything, including close relationships with family and friends. For many women, interactions with men bring fear. We feel duped, and we wonder how we miss the warning signs. Others are hanging on to their marriages, believing and hoping for change. Many are crushed by seeing the impact the betrayal is having on their sons' and daughters' sense of safety and self-confidence. Most of us are exhausted, and we cry out in pain, wondering where to go from here. One night, as I listened to my support group, I realized how much the porn industry was destroying my husband's heart and his ability to love me and our kids. Something inside me clicked. While Jaden is 100% responsible for his choices, I stopped seeing him as my enemy. I stumbled across this book called The Courtroom Ministry of Heaven and started praying for him and our marriage. It's not about putting a Band-Aid on the problem or ignoring what he needs to do. It's about agreeing with God to restore truth. Tracy. I, too, am a woman who has survived a series of traumas, and it caused me to believe a bill of goods about myself, others, and God. Through the crazy twists and turns along my path, I've come to know a mighty and loving Redeemer who I believe wants to say, "Precious daughter, I am with you. I am deeply grieved over what has happened to you. I am here to care and fight for you. Look for me. I am walking with you in the midst of your pain." Heavenly Horsepower. Can you imagine trying to get to know someone without using his or her name? My name, Sherry, means beloved or cherished one. I remember feeling chosen when Connor asked me to marry him. Unfortunately, that wasn't my experience. This psalm expressed my pain of rejection. Like a shattered clay pot, I am easily discarded and gladly replaced. Psalm 31, verse 12b. My very name, cherished, became my place of greatest injury. I felt unloved, unprotected, a throwaway. While most of us don't need to be convinced that life is difficult, it becomes confusing when we don't wrestle with the existence of evil and why horrible things happen to good people. Author John Eldridge says it well. Think of it. Why does every story have a villain? Little Red Riding Hood is attacked by a wolf. Dorothy must face and bring down the Wicked Witch of the West. Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi go hand in hand against Darth Maul. To release the captives of the Matrix, Neo battles the powerful agents. Frodo is hunted by the Black Riders, the Morgul blade that the Black Riders pierce Frodo with in the Battle of Weathertop. It was aimed at his heart. Beowulf kills the monster Grendel, and then he has to battle Grendel's mother. St. George slays the dragon. The children who stumbled into Narnia are called upon by Aslan to battle the White Witch and her armies so that Narnia might be free. Every story has a villain because yours does. You were born into a world at war. As a trauma therapist, I often sit with those who have had their sexuality broken into as young children. It takes my breath away, a chasm of immeasurable hurt. These wounds narrow us as we turn away from others and even our own hearts. I've spent years sitting with others who are asking what and why, for which often there are no satisfying answers. People and evil acts don't fit into nice, neat boxes, and neither does God. So when we can't explain egregious acts, we tend to project responsibility onto something or someone. It seems like a reasonable thing to do. Yet God's role in regard to evil is never as its author. Let's simply think about it. Sex trafficking, rape, hate crimes, child abuse, and sexual deception are counter-designed and ultimately degrade human dignity. So in an attempt to figure out this world of hurt, I began to study the names of God. Surprisingly, this is what I found. El Roy, which means the God who sees me. You are God who sees, because I have truly seen the one who looks after me. Genesis chapter 16, verse 13b. El Yeshuati, which means the God of my salvation. God, you're my last chance of the day. I spend the night on my knees before you. Put me on your salvation agenda. Take notes on the trouble I'm in. Psalm 88. Verse 1. Elohim Shema, which means the God who hears. You have seen me tossing and turning through the night. You have collected all my tears and preserved them in your bottle. You have recorded every one in your book. Psalm 56, verse 8. El Ahaneman, which means the God who is faithful. I would have lost heart unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. Psalm 27, verses 13 through 14. Jehovah Uzzi, which means the Lord my strength. The Lord is my strength and my safe cover. My heart trusts in him, and I am helped. So my heart is full of joy. I will thank him with my song. Psalm 28, verse 7. Jehovah Elameth, which means the Lord God of truth. True, some of them were unfaithful. But just because they were unfaithful, does that mean God will be unfaithful? Of course not. Though everyone else in the world is a liar, God is not. Romans chapter 3, verses 3 through 4a. Rumrosh, which means, the one who lifts my head. But Lord, you are my shield, my glory, and my only hope. You alone can lift my head, now bowed in shame. Psalm 3, verse 3. Theos Pasperklesis, which means the God of all comfort. I will comfort you there as a little one is comforted by its mother. Isaiah chapter 66 verse 13. Jehovah Jireh, which means the Lord will provide. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him, on those who hope in his unfailing love to deliver them from death and to keep them alive in famine. We wait in hope for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. Psalm 33, verses 18 through 20. Jehovah Palat, which means the Lord my deliverer. I love you, God. You make me strong. God is bedrock under my feet, the castle in which I live, my rescuing knight. Psalm 18, verse 1. Great verse. Jehovah Ori, which means the Lord is my light. This is expressed through the artwork on the cover of this audiobook. By your words, I can see where I'm going. They throw a beam of light on my dark path. Everything's falling apart on me, God. Put me together again with your word. Psalm 119, verses 105 and 107. Jehovah Ezer, which means the Lord is my help and champion. The Hebrew word Ezer describes aspects of God's character. You are my rock and my fortress, my soul's sanctuary. Therefore, for the sake of your reputation, be my leader, my guide, my navigator, my commander. Save me from the snare that has been secretly set out for me, for you are my protection. Psalm 31, verses 3 through 4a. So what does it look like to take God at his name? Janet called after finding out her husband was cheating. As she uncontrollably wept in my office, I cried out, "Mercy, mercy," to Elohim Shema, knowing that God counts her every tear. Tana feels spun out by manipulations, blame, and lies. I encouraged her to hang on to truth because Jehovah Elamet does. Beth felt buried by shame, like a caring friend who kindly looks into our eyes and gently lifts our head with truth. Our Rumrosh God reminds her of who she is and how much she's loved. Jennifer sits across the table with two opposing attorneys and wants to stay in her home. She courageously fights for what she wants as an act of restitution. We cry out to our provider, Jehovah Jireh. Sonia battles to save her marriage. She's in it for all she's worth. We press into the Lord who's mighty in battle, Jehovah Uzi. Imagine for a moment how it would feel to believe that God sees you and is for you. God is not a genie in a bottle, but an ever-present Ezer, help and champion in the time of need. We don't have to go it alone. God longs for us to trust him in the essence of his name. In your day of danger, may the Lord answer and deliver you. May the name of the God of grace set you safely on high. May supernatural help, Jehovah Ezer, be sent from his sanctuary. Psalm 20, verses 1 and 2a. What's in a name? 12 sets of eyes gazed my way as I sat in what was affectionately called the hot seat. I was at a week-long group intensive. Words like scrapper girl and Viking woman distastefully dropped into the room. Are you kidding me? I thought. I paid money for this? How could absolute strangers see me this clearly? The worst part of the whole experience is that these vivid word pictures were true. For years, I'd been scrapping for breadcrumbs from men out of a lonely desperation and a sense of worthlessness. I developed a sharp edge and kept others at arm's length, emotionally distancing myself for my own protection. The truth is, I'd been running, performing, wrestling, and hiding since I was 8 years old, running from danger with no quiet place to stop and rest. Like me, some women have learned to self-protect with an arsenal of weaponry, while others pull the covers over their heads. We try to isolate ourselves from pain, yet end up hating the isolation as we slowly begin to deteriorate in our own self-imposed tomb.